Well, when a man and a woman are first married, of course, they often have rose-colored glasses and starry-eyed optimism. And they believe all that their problems and pitfalls and the tensions that other couples face will not be theirs, right? Won't be their problem. And the reason for that seems obvious. It's because they are too much in love. And they are too smart for that. And they will overcome because, wait for it, they love each other. Doesn't that just get you? All right, well, maybe not. But still, I mean, that is kind of the neat thing about young couples. You watch them, they're in love, and they're kind of all, you know, arm in arm, and kind of look in each other's eyes, and you see all that, and you got to admire that, right? I mean, you got to admire that, because we all felt that once ourselves, for one. And also, that's the kind of optimism that we really want. So there's a romantic, there's the ideal that as far as love goes, but that refuses to look at the difficulty and the complexity of marriage in realistic terms. This is going to sound weird to say, but love by itself is not enough. You also need commitment. And commitment requires a lot of work. And remaining committed is going to be a lot of work, despite all the struggles. We're told to work out our salvation. Philippians 2, 12, 13 talks about that. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. I think that the same principle applies to marriage. You need to work out your commitment. Maybe not with fear and trembling, but you need to work out it with respect for what you've gotten involved in a marriage. And yes, you do have to have reverence for God who oversees all of that. Love is not enough by itself. Even God loves us, but his love by itself doesn't save us. And again, I know that almost sounds blasphemous because someone wants to say, but it does save us. Well, it's his love that motivated the action that was required by Christ and God and the Holy Spirit to seek our salvation and prepare for that. But it's not love by itself. God doesn't save us just because he loves us. And you're not going to save your marriage, so to speak, just because you love your husband or love your wife. That's not it by itself. It's certainly a most important component, but it is not it by itself. Thankfully, in a marriage, there are moments of bliss, passion, romance, adventure, and all those kinds of things. The reality is that there's considerably more moments of awkwardness and difficulty and compromise and forgiving and struggling to learn how this other person works, okay? Trying to learn to understand the other person. Love is part of the answer, and if a husband and wife make Christ his Lord, then they are going to show the proper love that they're supposed to have for each other, the proper respect that they're supposed to have for each other. They're going to conduct themselves not only in the right way, but they're also going to conduct themselves with the right motives. And that's what you want, right action, right motives. And it's Christ's love that inspires that right action and that right motive. Commitment, though, is another part, an integral part of this. When two people become one, that creates a new union or relationship that did not exist before. As we alluded to in our morning lesson, you have a man, you have a woman, and they come out of their own families, and they come together to create a new union that did not exist before. Now, instead of me and you, now there is us. Me and you did not disappear. That's all part of the equation still. There's still me and there's still you. But now there's a third entity, or we're going to look at it as a third dimension, really. Now there's us. This is a two-dimensional piece of paper, right? It's flat. But if it were three-dimensional, then it would have dimension. It would have a different spatial quality to it. And that's really what a marriage takes on. It's no longer just two people who are living by themselves, but when they come together and create us, it gives it, if you think about it in a figurative way, it gives it kind of a three-dimensional quality there. And a husband and wife need to have a godly appreciation and respect for that third dimension, for that commitment factor, as well as for each other. Now, not everyone gets this, especially up front, and not everyone gets this in marriage or discipleship, which I'm going to allude to throughout this lesson, but this is an excellent perspective to have, and it is one that is worthy of our attention tonight. So, there are two kinds of commitments, or you could say two aspects of commitment. One is devotion or dedication. The other one is constraint. This is what the author uses anyway as a word, and it's an interesting way of looking at it. another word might be obligation. And if you think about that, devotion and constraint, or dedication and obligation. Marriage needs both, not one or the other, because marriage cannot work on devotion alone, and marriage will not work on constraint alone. And I'll explain what these are. But you're going to see that it needs both. Devotion is really that personal desire and affection that you have for this person. You're drawn to who they are, what they have to offer, their personality, their character. So really this devotion is your faithfulness to that person because of those good qualities that you see in him or her. And that's good. We need that. We need to have that devotion or that dedication on that level. Constraint is a little bit more pragmatic and practical. It's this compelling reason that people stay together. In fact, it's a compelling reason to stay together even beyond love and affection. It's more of a sense of duty. It has something to do with even legal binding, like a marriage certificate and the sanctions of marriage and so on. The moral pressure to perform, that's all part of constraint here. And that compels a husband and a wife to stay together even when they don't really want to stay together. They may have lacked on devotion, and their dedication might go sour, but it's constraint that keeps them together, that obligation there. But you might think that that's a bad thing, but constraint is not a bad thing because it is equally found in healthy, God-fearing marriages as well. People stay together not just because of devotion, but also because of this constraint. So it's not a bad thing, but it's not meant to be the only thing as well. If you look at some constraint factors, in other words, what is constraint, you're going to see a list of them here. First of all, there's social pressure. There's the expectation of friends and family and society to perform. You guys got married, now you stay together. And there's a little bit of pressure on you to stay together. And that comes from family and friends and, again, society and so on. There's moral teachings, which is going to have an impact on your constraint. If you believe that divorce is wrong, morally wrong, well, then that's going to steer you away from divorce. And if you believe that marriage is right and that you should stay together, well, then that's going to steer you toward marriage. And so there's a moral constraint there as well. And again, none of these are bad. They're just there, and we're just pointing them out here. There's a concern for the welfare and the impact on the children and the relationship. How is this going to affect them? Some people say, I don't care how it affects them. It's my happiness above all. Okay. More people are going to have a concern for their children, and hopefully that will have an effect on the relationship. There's financial limitations. Some people stay together because they can't afford to live apart. And so there's a constraint factor that is built into that relationship. There is the difficulty of actually ending the marriage, of kind of what we might say crossing the Rubicon. Okay, if you know anything about Julius Caesar, crossing the Rubicon, declaring war, and all that. But still, the idea of the point of no return, maybe that's more familiar to us, okay? You go to the point of no return where it's like, if I step off here and end the marriage, that's a big step to take. And do I really want to do that? Am I cut out for that? Should I do that? And so on. There's all of those things that play into that. And then there's what the author calls alternative quality. In other words, life without your spouse and without marriage. And the scariness of that. And all of the particulars of that. The big change. So you're looking at that, and you might be looking at this and saying, well, some of those things really shouldn't be the only thing to consider. And you're right. They're not the only thing to consider. But they are all part of the equation. They're all factors to this thing that we call marriage. The danger signs of marriage, at least as this author brings out, is first of all, the couple is drifting. Their life has no objective and no fulfillment. They're just meandering like water. The second thing is that the only form of talking is arguing. That's the only kind of discussion they have is when they descend into an argument. And the third thing he points out, germane to our discussion here, is that they only focus on constraints, but not on devotion. In other words, this list here that you're seeing up on the screen, that's the only thing keeping them together. They've lost their devotion. They've lost their love for one another. You might recall that we started out this series with a lesson called Returning to Your First Love. Okay? And we talked about the need to have that devotion and the need to have love in that relationship. And now I'm taking you back in your mind to that lesson and recalling what we talked about there, if indeed you remember. And if you don't, we can always drum up the CDs or the outlines. That's what they're there for, okay? But this is what we're talking about. Someone gets so focused on the constraint factors, but they've lost sight of the dedication. That's not good. In order to understand what commitment is and what it ought to be, we also need to shatter some myths, what the author calls myths about maybe. I'm going to call them maybe myths because I think it sounds better, okay? Plus, you got the alliteration thing going. And anyway, so a person says, and I didn't put all the maybe things that he had in there, but a person says, well, maybe I can have it all. Maybe I can have, you know, this relationship with my wife and still kind of play the field, or, you know, still kind of do things out here and still kind of live on the edge and, you know, do all that. And that's just impossible. You can't commit to everything all at once. In fact, you cannot commit to two or more opposing choices all at once. Giving up all other choices is itself a choice, and it is a mature choice at that. Every commitment involves loss. When you choose one thing or one person, you necessarily relinquish your opportunity for what was not chosen. If you choose to be married, for example, then you give up singlehood. Okay? If you choose to marry your spouse, then that means that you gave up all other candidates who could have been your spouse, and so on. And if you choose Christ, then that means you give up all other lords, as I'll talk about here in just a moment. But someone says something like, well, maybe we shouldn't have gotten married, or maybe it just wasn't meant to be. And when you hear that kind of dialogue, and I have heard this kind of dialogue from people in the past, it indicates two people who really never took maybe off the table. They really didn't understand what commitment was. They always left maybe on the table. They always left their options on the table, so to speak. And so they go into this relationship and they say to each other, I'm going to commit to you. And the other person says, oh, I'm going to commit to you. But you get into the relationship a little ways, and we all know what happens in about the second year, and then the fifth year, and then the seventh year, and the tenth year. You start to hit these pockets of difficulty and struggle. And when couples hit those pockets or hit those time frames, and everybody goes through them, it's just human nature, then they start looking outside the marriage and go, well, you know, maybe I do have some more options here I hadn't really thought of before. And the only reason you're thinking about it is because things are going badly. And that's where that lack of commitment really becomes extremely serious. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, Jesus says, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. You have to realize that Jesus is not looking for maybe disciples. You know, disciples who say something along the line of, hey, I'm going to go forward with you, but at the same time, I'm going to go into some other directions. I'm going to pursue some other angles as well. Now, don't get me wrong, Jesus, my hat is in with you and so on. But at the same time, you've got to realize that, you know, I've got to keep my options open and that sort of thing. And that's just not going to work. Jesus does not accept that. Your marriage should not accept that. You should not accept that. In fact, deep and uninhibited devotion and intimacy is only possible when maybe is off the table, and instead of people saying, maybe I will, they say, I will, I do, I am, and the maybe's gone. And I want you to think about this, seriously. No hands, no, you know, don't give it away, all right? But look at your own marriage and ask yourself, is maybe still on the table? Because if it is, you've got problems. Whether you realize it or not, you've got serious problems there. You need to move maybe off the table altogether and say, no, we are committed, no matter what. And that has to be with your devotion to Christ. That has to be with your devotion to your spouse, okay? Because these are important commitments that you have made. Maybe the grass is greener on the other side. You know, Dick Siegenthaler has ruined my driving my truck experience. I want you to understand, Dick let me drive his nice super-powered V8 engine with the, you know, all the fuel-injected everything that he's got on there, his little Cadillac there, and I distinctly remember me telling you about this, Dick, I get out of your car at your house, and then I climb back into my little four-cylinder pickup truck, and it's just not the same. Okay? And I didn't realize how gutless and useless my truck was until, of course, I got out of that V8 supercharged engine, and yeah, you get the picture. People are like that sometimes with relationships. They start dabbling in other relationships, and they start imagining, and they start fantasizing, and yes, sometimes they get involved with other people, and they get that big thrill of, wow, so this is what it's like to drive a V8, you know, and then they come home to their little four-cylinder engine, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? And it's just not the same. And the fact is, we're making comparisons there that really are not legitimate comparisons, okay? I've talked about this a little more in another lesson already, but just think about that point. Or here's another analogy using the same kind of illustration. If my truck never gives me trouble, I'm not going to be thinking about replacing it. The only time I really think about replacing my vehicle is when the thing breaks down, right? And when you're sitting there on the side of the road waiting for a tow truck, you know, kicking the tire of the car as it's broken down, I can just about guarantee what's at least going through your mind is maybe it's time to get a new one. And you never really thought about that until, of course, this thing broke down. It's not working for you as well as you wanted it to. And marriage kind of works on those same principles as well. You're just completely content with your wife until she does something that really bothers you or that really disturbs you or that she just doesn't, you know, function the way that she's supposed to function. And then you start looking outside. Up until that point, you were fine with her. But now, you know, we're sitting on the side of the road. We got this marriage in a breakdown scenario, waiting for the tow truck, so to speak, the counselor or whoever. And it's just not really going to work as you see it. And so then you start looking outside that. These things apply to relationships as well. So imagine you say to Christ, for example, you know, I'm going to commit to you, Jesus, for life. But I also want to keep my options open in case something better comes along. Imagine that he's just got to be filled with all kinds of pride and glory. And isn't that honorable to say to him? Now, that's not going to work with Jesus. You know that. It's not going to work in marriage either. The author suggests in order to avoid the grass is greener on the other side of the fence syndrome, first of all, stay away from the fence. And then secondly, work on your own lawn. In other words, do something to get your grass greener, if you will. Because the only reason you're focusing on the other side of the fence is because your side isn't, you've not really been doing anything yourself, perhaps. I'm not saying it's all your fault. What I'm saying is take care of what is within your responsibility and what God expects you to take care of. Let me say something, too. And the author spends quite a bit of time on this, and if this is a subject that you need to explore further, then read the book. But one thing he talks about is you may stumble across someone in your life with whom you might have had a happier life than your spouse. That happens. You kind of, you know, whether at the workplace or through the church or just in other circles, social circles, you actually stumble across what might have been, you know, the ideal person. And if you're not careful, that can make you angry and resentful. What he recommends, and I fully agree with this aspect, is to, first of all, acknowledge the loss. And then secondly, to grieve the loss. Because it is a little death. It is a grieving process to acknowledge that and to deal with it in that way. And thirdly, get on with your life. Because you can't sit there in fantasy or what ifs and what could have been. You just can't live there. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't. All right? I'll let you pursue that if you need to. You can't throw everything away just because you don't have exactly what you want. That's just life. You can't throw everything away just because you don't have exactly what you want. I'm not going to get rid of my little red truck just because I don't have a nice V8 Cadillac. It's just not worth it to go that direction. Maybe it should be all about me, someone says. You know, it is next to impossible to expect genuine commitment from selfish people. Dr. Stanley says in his book, the one who is less committed has more power. in the relationship. And you might look at that and you say, no, it's just the other way around. No, it's this way. I think he's right. First of all, he or she cares less what happens to the relationship. So therefore, that person is willing to take bigger risks because he does not care, like threatening to leave. And thirdly, he has the other person over a barrel. He capitalizes on his wife's devotion to the relationship. So this is the person who's always saying, well, you know, if you don't do this, I'm just going to leave. Well, we're just going to get a divorce. And the other person goes, no, don't do that, don't do that. And he knows that he's got her because she's not going to give up this thing because she is too committed. She's at least got moral backbone, and she's got some sense of, you know, there's a bigger picture here than just you or me. But this guy is going to take advantage of that, and he's actually less committed but has more power over the relationship. Maybe you know what I'm talking about here. And it's all because he's a selfish person. And such people sacrifice their devotion to the relationship because they lack constraint. And that's a moral defect that can be fixed, but it's a moral weakness and is selfishness in itself. And that itself stems from a failure to respect God and his laws. For example, God says, husbands, love your wives, or wives, love your husbands, and to all of us, humble yourselves before the Lord. And the person says, I will not do that. You think that hasn't happened in history? Turn over to Jeremiah chapter 16, or chapter 6, verse 16 with me, and we'll see exactly that. This has already been recorded. This is exactly how people act. Israel did it to God. Wives do it to their husbands. Husbands do it to their wives. Jeremiah chapter 6 and verse 16. Thus says the Lord, stand by the ways and see and ask for the ancient paths where the good way is and walk in it, and you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. And I set watchmen over you, saying, listen to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we will not listen. And why did they not do these things? Because they're selfish people. And if you keep on reading, you're going to find out that then this is what's going to happen to you because you're selfish and not listening to me. There's going to be bad things happening to you. And I know what someone's going to say today. Well, that was then when God was doing all the whole judgment on nations thing. But now today it's different, right? God's just a loving God and he forgives everyone. And, you know, he's just not going to do that. Well, I don't know if he's going to carry out his wrath in this lifetime or not. But his wrath will be carried out. And it will be against such people who say, I will not, when you say to do something. Do you really want to take that risk? Do you really want to challenge God in that way? Remember how powerful God is. He runs the whole universe by his own power. You don't want to mess with someone with that kind of power. When he says to do something, it would be in your best interest to do what he says. And if he says, husbands, love your wives, husbands, it would be in your best interest to love your wives. And wives, when he says, submit to your husbands, it would be in your best interest to do that. And when he says to all of us, humble yourselves before the Lord, that serves our best interest as well. But shaking our fists in defiance at God does not do anyone any good at all. Commitment, on the other hand, involves devotion and constraint, as we said earlier. Love for the person and dutiful respect for the pact itself, for the us. Not just for the me or the you, but for the us. Marriage is a special kind of covenant agreement, one superseded only by one's covenant agreement with God himself. When a couple says, I do, they are both agreeing to the terms and the conditions of that covenant in the sight of God. They're not just agreeing to each other. It's true, they are agreeing to each other. You know, remember wedding vows you see at any wedding ceremony? The husband pledges his life to her, and she pledges his life to him. And of course, there's that, you know, that mutual pledging going on, which is fine. But what they're really always doing is they're also looking outside of them, and they're saying, in essence, even though they don't word it this way, they're saying, in essence, now there's not just me and you, now there's us. And I pledge my commitment to the us. I pledge my commitment to that other thing that we just created, this union that we have created called marriage. So when a person says to his wife or a wife says to her husband, I do or I will, they're not saying maybe I will, because that's not commitment. And no covenant can be established on maybe. I mean, think about it. This just doesn't work that way. And when two people say, I do, they can't say, I do for now. Because no relationship can last when devotion and constraint can change without notice. And imagine God offering his salvation on these terms here, right? Imagine God saying, well, maybe I do, and maybe I don't, right? Or, yeah, I do, I'll help you for now. Imagine that kind of commitment from God. Well, you say, well, that's not really commitment at all. That's my point exactly, okay? That is not commitment at all. That's why it can't be this way. And when people say I do to each other, they can't say I do unless you disappoint me. This is unrealistic and it is presumptuous. Everybody disappoints everyone at some time or another. I've said many times, I'll say it again because it fits in the lesson. If I haven't let you down yet, I will. You've just got to give me more opportunity, okay? Because that's really what's going to happen. Eventually, I'm going to disappoint you. And your wife is going to disappoint you, husbands. And husbands, you are going to disappoint your wives. And that's life. We're not endorsing it. We're not saying it's okay. We're just simply acknowledging the fact that that's going to happen. Now imagine if God said to you, I'm going to save you. I'm going to commit to you. I'm going to do all kinds of things for you. Unless, of course, you disappoint me. We don't have a hope. Because it's just a matter of time before we will. So when we're looking at what we want from God as far as his commitment to us, we should start applying those same things and those same principles to what we are committing to with our husbands and our wives here. Dr. Stanley says at one point in his book, he says, commitment requires action. You can't just sit back and reflect on it or wish you had it. And this is true in every kind of commitment, including your commitment to God. You can't just sit back and dream about, wouldn't it be nice if we had this great pact, this us? Wouldn't it be nice if we had a commitment together? These principles apply to one's commitment to a congregation as well, to the Lord's work as much as they do to marriage. Those with a strong commitment level have, and this is not surprising, strong devotion and strong constraint factors as well. In other words, they truly care about God and his people. There's that devotion. But they also have a strong sense of moral responsibility toward the group. When you look out in any congregation and you start naming the strong people in that congregation, I guarantee they will be the people of devotion and the people of moral obligation. Because those are the kind of people who commit, for better or worse, in sickness and in health, right? Richer or poorer, they commit all across the board. And they do not put maybe on the table. They have swept maybe off the table. There is no maybe with those people. Those are the strong people in any congregation. And those who participate as little as possible and yet still want to be acknowledged as a member, they have a shallow devotion and or a weak constraint, and it's not surprising if you see that shallow devotion and or weak constraint in other areas of their lives as well. In other words, if they have a very passive, milquetoast kind of, you know, well, maybe not relationship with the congregation, you're going to see that same thing probably in their marriage, in their friendships, in their family, in their ethic at work, and so on. You're going to see that same thing because that's the kind of people they are. This can change. They don't have to stay that way, but that's where they're at right now. And we would certainly encourage them to do something about that. Luke 9:62, part of the scripture reading here, Jesus said to the man who said, just let me go back and say goodbye and so on, no one after putting his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. That's a powerful passage. Being fit for the kingdom requires nothing short of total commitment. It doesn't mean that you're going to know everything up front. It doesn't mean that you're going to understand everything you commit to up front. And it doesn't mean that you will never stumble. What it means is that you promise up front never to quit and never to abandon your commitment. And you are going to promise to work on that commitment so that you will never abandon and never quit. That's what Jesus is looking for. And a man or a woman who will not make this promise to God is not fit for the kingdom. And I'm going to submit to you, too, that a man who will not make that promise to his wife-to-be or a woman to her husband-to-be, those people are not fit for marriage either. At least not yet. Remember, it's a mature decision. Not everyone's mature enough to become a married person. I know, unfortunately, immature people still get married, but the fact is we're trying to be realistic and hopefully proactive about this. Dr. Stanley has another great quote here. He says, great marriages are built over time. They are like multiple course dinners with varying dishes, flavors, and stages. Not an instant meal heated up in a microwave. Not a new thought, I know, but nice way to put it. Interesting way to look at it. Commitment is something that you make up front, but you strengthen and work on it over time because you need time. Time is a relative factor here, a relevant factor here in this sense, because if you don't work on your commitment, then it will deteriorate over time. Nature takes its course. Look what happens in nature. If you leave a piece of property over time, it's going to erode because the forces of nature are going to pound on it and it's going to start disintegrating. Leave a car out for 50 years in the driveway and you guarantee you come back to it, it's going to be a lot less than what it was because it just erodes over time. And marriages do the same thing. You don't work on it, you don't do anything, you leave it out in the weather, so to speak, and it's just going to start deteriorating. There's things that you have to do then. It's not enough that you say, we committed together when we got married. Okay, that's a great start, but what have you done with that commitment since then? That's what you need to look at. In 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5 through 7, well-known passage. Not going to take time to go there, but you know the passage. Peter says, add to your faith with all diligence, knowledge, and self-control, and moral excellence, and all those different things. Seven different virtues he mentions there. What he's getting at is your faith, left to itself, is going to deteriorate unless you continue to add to it. And so you've got to add to your marriage the same way. There are things you need to continuously add to that marriage and put diligent effort toward it. Otherwise, like your faith, it will falter and die. So your commitment to your husband and your wife is one of the most important in your life, but your commitment to Christ is the most important in your life. My question to you as we close here is, how is your commitment to Him? Are you claiming that you're dedicated to Christ, but you feel no constraint? You got all devotion, but no constraint? Or are you saying, well, I feel so obligated, but I really don't love Him? Well, there's all constraint and no devotion. What you really want is that healthy balance, devotion and constraint working together. That's our lesson on commitments. We'll continue in our series next week. If you need to respond to that lesson tonight, then you're invited to come forward if you need to, as we stand and sing.